Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
We were hamstrung in our operations for more than a decade because of having to pay the federal government death tax liabilities over that period of time.
Testifying at a field hearing for the House Ways and Means Committee, California rancher Kevin Kester.
Now that having bonus depreciation and the increase in Section 179 deductions, it means everything for us being able to have the capital to stay in reserve and not have to pay for taxes, to use it for investing in our communities. It vibrates all the way through our economy with equipment manufacturers, feed stores, retails, and so it's vastly important.
This is Agriculture Today.
New marketing assistance loan rates were established under the One Big Beautiful Bill signed by President Trump back on the 4th of July. The loan rates, which support key commodities, apply from the 2026 through 2031 crop years. Now, most rates increase by 10%, except for upland cotton, which rose by a variable amount depending on its previous pricing structure. Now, the change mirrors earlier proposals from the House Ag Committee and provides farmers with more financial certainty for marketing decisions. The program allows producers to use their stored crops as collateral for operating loans. It's designed to support cash flow after harvest while allowing for delayed marketing. Now, for upland cotton, the new flat rate, 55 cents per pound, up from an effective floor of 52 cents under the 2018 Farm Bill. USDA's Farm Service Agency has released updated guidance to help producers evaluate the program's benefits. Farmers are encouraged to consider the marketing assistance loan as part of a comprehensive risk and marketing strategy, especially as interest rates and input costs remain elevated. BNSF Railway adjusting corn rail tariff rates for the marketing year, cutting rates to Hereford, Texas, while keeping rates to the Pacific Northwest export terminals unchanged. Now, the changes affect BNSF's shuttle program, which moves 110 to 120 car trains of grain under contract. Corn has been the top rail hauled grain commodity, and BNSF leads in carloads. Now, for most elevators on BNSF's network, rates to Hereford will decline. For example, the rate from St. Joseph, Missouri will fall by $600 per car. It's a drop of about 15 cents per bushel. In contrast, the PNW rates will remain flat. Resulting PNW Hereford tariff spread is a key metric guiding corn flows. Elevators in South Dakota and Minnesota may now favor the Pacific Northwest, while those in Iowa and Nebraska would favor Texas. Corn delivered prices will ultimately influence flows more than tariffs alone. USDA projects a record 15.7 billion bushels of U.S. corn production this year, with large acreage increases in the Dakotas. Corn from those states may flow west to the PNW. New rates take effect in October and reflect growing efforts to optimize rail efficiency. Well, USDA's latest peanut stocks and processing report shows commercial peanut stocks reached 2.17 billion pounds as of June 30th, up from 1.94 billion pounds 1 year ago. That includes 1.45 billion pounds of farmer stock. Now, despite strong stocks, edible grade utilization for the season down 1% from last year. Meanwhile, price received by farmers averaging 26.2 cents per pound for the week ending July 19th. And California remains the nation's top peach producing state. USDA's May crop production forecast shows a 4% increase in total peach output for 2025. Production expected to hit 550,000 tons, an 11% increase over the three-year average. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
So King Charles is an environmentalist.
Speaking to reporters in Scotland, President Trump.
And I say that in a positive way, not a negative way. And every time I've met with him, he talked about the environment, how important it is. And I'm all for it. I think that's great. You know, King Charles, more than anything else, loves the country. But I got to know him very well. He truly is an environmentalist. He wants clean air, clean water, you know, all of the things that we all want.
President meeting with the Prime Minister of the UK, Keir Starmer, on energy and wind.
Wind is a disaster.
But in Scotland and across the UK, wind farms...
I know, it's a shame. It's not his fault. I used to tell Alex Salmon...
Have you spoken to the Prime Minister and will you speak to the first...
Well, all I can do is give my... Look, wind is the most expensive form of energy, and it destroys the beauty of your fields and your plains and your waterways. And look out there, there's no windmills. But if you look in another direction, you see windmills. When we go to Aberdeen, you'll see some of the ugliest windmills you've ever seen. They're the height of a 50-story building. And you could take 1,000 times more energy out of a hole in the ground this big. This big. It's called oil and gas. And you have it there, the North Sea. This big, that nobody would even see. You can take 1,000 times more power because the wind is intermittent. It doesn't work. It's extremely expensive. All the windmills are made in China. They used to be Germany and China. Now they're mostly in China. They all come out of China. They say that the blades, which are carbon fiber, you can't bury. Oh, okay, you can't bury. What are you going to do, dump them in the ocean someplace? Because they only last a certain period of time. And remember, a windmill has a life of 8 years, especially when they're out in the salty sea and they start to rot and to rust. You're going to have to replace them. It's very hard to replace them. Wind needs massive subsidy. And you are paying in Scotland and in UK and all over the place where they have massive subsidies to have these ugly monsters all over the place. So I've restricted windmills in the United States. Now, a couple we have, you know, the poor, stupid people at the beginning, they approved them. So they have their full approvals. But I've restricted windmills in the United States because they also kill all your birds. You know, they wipe out. You know, it's interesting. If you shoot a bald eagle in the United States, they put you in jail for 5 years. And yet windmills knock out hundreds of them. They don't do anything. You explain that. So it's a very expensive energy. It's a very ugly energy. And we won't allow it in the United States.
So we believe in a mix. And obviously oil and gas is going to be with us for a very long time. That'll be part of the mix. But also wind, solar, increasingly nuclear, which is what we've been discussing this morning, civil nuclear as we go forward. The most important thing for the United Kingdom is that we have control of our energy and we have energy independence and security. Because at the moment, whatever the attributes and facilities in the North Sea, that is sold onto the international market. We buy it back off the international market. That was a historic mistake in my view. But what we need is a mix so that we get the energy security that we need for the future, and that's the focus of everything that we're doing. But what we have discussed today is that the energy prices are too high, which is why we recently took measures to reduce the energy prices, particularly for energy-intensive businesses. But in the long run, the only way to reduce your energy prices is to take control of your energy, and that's what we're doing, taking control of our energy.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
CRP is a critical tool for improving wildlife habitat, water quality, soil health.
At a recent Senate Ag Committee confirmation hearing for Richard Fordyce to be Undersecretary of Ag for Farm Production and Conservation at USDA with Senator Amy Klobuchar.
Leader Thune and I have long partnered to improve CRP. Will you commit to working with me and others on improvements to CRP, including improvements to the USDA that the USDA currently has the authority to make?
Yes, absolutely. And I would say that, you know, CRP now is, 40 years old. And, you know, I think that is truly a success story and the evolution of CRP, the different practices that have come about. So, yeah, yes, ranking member, I definitely would commit to working with you as we improve CRP.
Okay, so when confirmed, you're going to go walk into a lot. FPAC has lost nearly 4,100 employees in the deferred resignation program. FSA alone has lost over 1,000 employees, and there are offices who have understaffed or unstaffed. This is particularly troubling as Congress has tasked USDA with implementing economic and disaster relief this year. And the recently enacted reconciliation bill will require FSA to sign up 30 million new base acres over the next year. As a former administrator of FSA, do you think having offices open, available, and fully staffed is important? How do you believe FPAC can meet its mission of serving farmers with these kinds of reductions of 4,100 employees?
You know, I haven't had an opportunity, but will, once confirmed, to dig into the data, understand where those retirements came from, where they're located. And certainly, you know, I cannot say enough about the folks that work. And it's across all three agencies within the mission area, but I'm most familiar with the Farm Service Agency, and they are, again, some of the greatest folks, that you'll ever meet and ever work with. And so again, understanding what that is, looking at the data. But I'm confident, Senator, that we can deliver our mission critical responsibilities in a very positive way.
Very good. Last question. I look forward to building on the work that was begun in the 2018 Farm Bill to improve USDA efficiency and provide farmers with a better understanding of the potential economic farming benefits, not only of the commodities programs and the like, but also conservation practices. Advances in data paired with widespread adoption of precision ag technology present exciting opportunities to empower farmers with the best tools available. Senator Thune and I, again, have an Agriculture Innovation Act, and then Senator Fish and I have partnered on another bill. How do you think the USDA can partner with academic institutions and other researchers to better inform the conservation practices, and what barriers does USDA face in using data and working more closely on conservation?
Well, I do appreciate that question a great deal, because that's an area that I'm very interested in, very passionate about. I think that there's an opportunity for USDA and the FPAC mission area, more specifically, to maybe it's understand the technologies better, and how can those work to create better opportunities for the farmers and ranchers that we serve. I would just say that there's a lot there, and you know, I would commit that we will do what we can to learn more about it, understand it, and see what kind of a partnership could exist.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
No, they're meeting right now, and you know, we have a good relationship with China.
President Trump speaking from Scotland on trade deals.
China's tough, and like you're tough, you know, we're all tough, yes. But we're going to see what happens. We just concluded our deal with Japan. It was very good for everybody. We're making, you know, great deals. We're making deals that are good for us, but we want them to be good for everybody. It's important that sometimes I'll do something that I shouldn't do because it's not very important for our country, but it's very meaningful for the country on the other side. And I'll let them have that point because it's very important for them. So, I don't know, but we've made a lot of deals in the last couple of months. And then ultimately, as you might as well know, we're going to just, because we have, you know, you have 200 countries, more, but people don't know that. You've got a lot of countries. And I wouldn't want to sit down with 200 people and have to deal the way he was calling me all the time. We want this. We got to have that. These are tough negotiators. These are, you know, look, they're smart people. They're tough negotiators. They know what they want. But we're going to be setting a tariff for essentially the rest of the world. And that's what they're going to pay if they want to do business in the United States. Because you can't sit down and make 200 deals. But we've made the big ones. We just finished Indonesia. They opened up their country. We just finished Japan. They opened up their country. You know, Japan opened up the country. They were totally closed. They opened up to our cars, even to rice. Rice was a big deal. They would never take anybody else's rice. They'd take in rice. But they opened up their country. Philippines, we just finished. They opened up their country. They were very closed. I'd love to see China open up their country. So we're dealing with China right now, as we speak. Yeah, we're dealing with China right now.
Trump admits, however, that times have been extremely challenging for those in the farming community.
As you know, in our tax bill, we have a clause that's very important. We were losing a lot of farms to the banks because a loving mother and father would die and left their farm to their children or their child, but their children, their family. And they loved their family, and they thought they were doing them a favor. But they had a 50% tax to pay, so the land would get valued, and at a high number, because some of the farms were valuable, but they didn't, you know, they couldn't quantify it. And they'd go out and borrow money to pay the estate tax or the death tax, as it's called, and they'd overextend, and they'd lose the farm, and they'd commit suicide in many cases.
We're seeing that.
There is no estate tax on farmers. So when a parent leaves their farm, because again, a lot of these farms, they don't make a lot of money, but it's a way of life, and they love their way of life, and they love that dirt. Their dirt is the most beautiful thing they've ever seen. They love it. I mean, they're farmers. They love doing it. They don't know how to do anything else, but they don't want to do anything else. I speak to farmers. I say, would you like to live in my penthouse in Manhattan? It's always beautiful. No, sir, I want this farm. And what happens is, we were losing a lot of people to suicide. They'd borrow money to pay the estate tax, and they were not able to pay it. And some banks are ruthless. They wouldn't do anything, and they would end up committing suicide. We have totally ended the estate tax in those situations, so there's no estate tax. So when a parent leaves the farm to the kids, they don't have to worry about their local, possibly unfriendly banker coming in and stealing their farm.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Mr. Fordyce, you've had extensive engagement with the Farm Service Agency. How do you plan to best utilize the FSA County office employees while also improving technology and communication between FSA and the RMA to provide exceptional service to producers across the country?
Richard Fordyce at a confirmation hearing to become Undersecretary of Ag for Farm Production and Conservation at USDA with the chairman, John Bozeman.
I've been out and about a lot for the last couple of years in regard to trying to get together a farm bill, trying to help our farmers. But in talking to the FSA people, it's not unusual for them to talk about having to get into multiple different entities in order to get the information they need in order to do things in a timely fashion.
I too have had those very same conversations. When I was the administrator in the first administration, we implemented a lot of programs, most notably the 2018 Farm Bill. With those implementations, it lots of times creates the necessity to create software that supports that implementation. And I think I can safely say, and I think others would probably agree, probably some in the room, that a lot of our technologies are woefully old. And antiquated, I would almost say, in some cases. And so certainly there is a need for some modernization in the tools that are used by FSA to deliver those programs. We probably could see some modernization in the ways that we participate with the producers that we serve at FSA.
The other thing that we hear a lot about is just the time that it takes in dealing with the loan process. We hear that from applicants and lenders across the board. I think it's gotten a little bit better, but it's still a problem. So, again, I know that's something that you're well aware of. And hopefully we'll be able to have you back in several months and you tell us a good story as to how we're moving in the right direction in that regard. So many of these things are just inefficiencies that wouldn't make, they cost some money, but the efficiency will gain us so much, and it's just a matter of us helping you to get those things done. You've got a wealth of experience both on the farm and in leadership at USDA. How can existing federal programs be expanded or modified to better support young and beginning farmers and ranchers?
Well, again, Senator, a good question, and I appreciate that question. I think that all of us probably in this room certainly have an eye to the next generation and that population that is new or beginning farmers. And, we're all probably pretty aware of the capital requirements and things that it does take to start a farm. They can be enormous. And so, I think that in some cases, I think depending on where you are located geographically, what your history has been as a new farmer or beginning farmer, I think we could probably do a better job of outreach and communication, making those new and beginning farmers more aware of what's available that can be of assistance and can be of help to starting a new farm. Not only from a program standpoint, a financial standpoint, but also even as a mentorship standpoint. And I think we could look to do that.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
It's interesting to see how our crop is shaping up.
Mark Brown is Director of Field Services with Lubbock-based Plains Cotton Growers.
Across the South Plains, the crop really looks good and is holding up well to the heat. We're fortunate, Tony, that we have not had as many 100-degree-plus days as what we've typically had. In fact, we've had about 3 days thus far in July with a potential in the 10-day forecast of another one or two of those. But prior to that, we've only had about 4 days above 100 in May and June. So we've had very near normal, or very near perfect, I should say, heat unit accumulation for cotton as far as this year goes. As we look across the area, our crop is a little bit behind, perhaps, maybe 10 days behind. Some of this crop is late. In fact, we've got some fields that are not in bloom as of yet, and we'd like to see everything in bloom. But if we can get fields close to blooming by the 1st of August, then we should still have about 3 weeks to set fruit in that Lubbock area prior to the time that what we consider to be the last effective bloom date.
While much of that area has suffered from drought over the last 3 years, there has been more moisture here this year.
Well, along with the rain, that has brought a lot of weeds. And along with weeds and a little more diversity out there in the fields, then we have seen opportunities for pests to build up out there, somewhat more so than we have the last several years when we've experienced such drought. And so we have had some pest issues. Now, fortunately, for most people, it has not been anything that has been just terrible pest pressure, but we have had to watch fields. Aphids have been a concern this year, and I don't remember the last time that we've had aphid pressure. Now, fortunately, with that rainfall, with those weeds, also we see a lot of beneficials out in the fields. And where people have been careful and have been patient, in many cases, I'm hearing consultants talking about the fact that these aphids are being taken out by the beneficial populations, which is a very good thing. And then also, we have a different type of insecticide chemistry than we did many years ago, and that is also softer on the beneficials and tends not to cause aphids to explode behind an insecticide application. Some people have had to manage flea hoppers, and in many fields we've had above threshold levels of flea hoppers, and so those had to be sprayed. Also, where we put out plant growth regulators, in some cases, people put out an application to manage insects at that point in time. And so far, we have, I think, done a good job of keeping a handle on the pest populations and also allowing time for those beneficials to come in and to clean up a lot of those populations naturally. And that's always a good thing.
Mark Brown, Plains Cotton Growers. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
This research isn't terribly new. We've had
using satellites to improve irrigation, USDA's Kyle Nipper.
Incredible researchers, particularly at ARS, developing this technology over the last few decades. But I think what we've been able to do in more recent years is kind of co-opt this cooperative research partnership with private industry, with universities, and with the federal government, particularly ARS. So we're able to sit down at a table with them, like if we're talking with wine grapes, working really closely with Gallo Wineries. The Almond Board of California is a really close partner with us, California Olive Ranch, and sit down with them and we show them what we've been working on in terms of research and what is it that they would like to see in terms of a tool, what would be easy for their irrigation managers, for their growers to go on a website and get this information. So that's been really rewarding working with them.